day-to-day swings in the natural gas prices are not going to affect this project.
TransCanada says the faltering economy won't halt their gas line plans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 26th of January. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, a state official expresses frustration over efforts to help Imonic residents.
If there was a way to do something today, we would all be doing it. We all operate under constraints of law.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
The Palin administration could offer no solution today for the economic stress in the village of Imonic, but says it's still working on it. After visiting the community, state officials say it does not qualify for either a disaster declaration or an economic emergency declaration. All villagers are left with is a stepped-up effort to sign them up with existing programs. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
It doesn't fit the state emergency services guidelines or the Commerce Department's. State law no longer gives them the discretion to simply declare an emergency because of dire economic circumstances. Commerce Commissioner Emil Nadi says they've been meeting with local officials, but in essence, they have no new initiative to announce to help villages where the cash economy has shrunk and fuel prices have skyrocketed to the point where people have to choose between heating their homes and using fuel to get food or firewood.
This administration and the governor's office is concerned about the situation in Imonic and everyone who's involved here. If there was a way to do something today, we would all be doing it. We all operate under constraints of law.
The story was the same from General Craig Campbell, head of the State Emergency Services Division in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. He says the legislature changed the process after the disasters declared due to poor fish runs.
Before 2000, the legislature basically had everything dealing with disasters covered by DMVA, but the change in public policy was made, which changed Title 26, refining what my response for disasters are to disasters such as terrorist attacks, outbreak of disease, oil spills, avalanches, earthquakes, those type of events. It separated out economic circumstances like poor fish runs and shortages of fuel and food and specified that over to Commissioner Nadi's department.
But a clearly frustrated Commissioner Nadi said the situation simply does not fit the guidelines for him to recommend a declaration.
The Department of Commerce, under conditions Title 44, we can declare or ask the governor to declare an economic emergency. The situation out there does not meet the requirements of income to declare a declaration of emergency.
Nadi said it's true that average income in the village has declined due to the lack of a commercial salmon opening. But the real problem was the timing of the fuel delivery. The state is offering a fuel loan and is making people aware that they may qualify for low-income fuel assistance, which applies even at 2.25 times the federally defined poverty level. The State Health and Social Services Department has two people in the village this week helping people sign up for existing assistance programs. The Fish and Game Department is looking at potential liberalization of moose hunting, and the Transportation Department is looking at any capital projects in the western part of the state that it can accelerate to get cash flowing into any communities. Nadi said fuel vendors are reluctant to sell on credit right now. Some in the legislature have talked about setting up a program to issue vouchers villagers could use to purchase fuel. Nadi characterized that idea as preliminary.
Fuel vouchers is something that's been has not been discussed in detail. It's been mentioned, but we'd have to do some research on, see what we can do. We're going to first trigger and get out in the field all the existing programs that we can, and if that works its way through the process, you know, it's something that will be considered.
Some in Imonic say it's the lack of a commercial salmon fishery this year that pushed things to the breaking point. Nadi says, unfortunately, in Imonic, that did not drop average income down enough to go below the poverty line. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
An official with BP last week said the national economy and low energy prices in the continental U.S. are lowering the chances for the Denali gas pipeline project his company and ConocoPhillips have announced. The Denali plan is in competition with TransCanada's project that is in partnership with the state. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports that TransCanada says it is still very confident of its project.
In a presentation to the Alaska Support Industry Alliance last week, the president of BP's gas marketing division, Brian Frank, said the national economic conditions have had a major downward effect on their customers, and that's cut demand and prices. He also referred to increased imports of liquefied natural gas, new shale gas discoveries within the lower 48, and increased use of renewable energy and other factors pulling the project away from the top priority it was a year ago. At the same meeting, Houston-based economist Ed Kelly predicted that the Alaska project would at the least be taken off the urgent list for the developing companies. However, TransCanada, working under the aegis of Alaska's gas line license, says they're not bothered by the short-term detractions. Tony Palmer, president of the Alaska project, says they're looking at the conditions that will prevail when the line is finished. He says his company is keeping its focus on the cost of elements of the project and keeping it on schedule.
Of course, natural gas prices are important. Competitors for the marketplace are important, but we don't control those things, and you must take a long view. This project is to be in service just over 9 years from now, and then to be in service for 25 to 50 years beyond that. That's what's important. Day-to-day swings in the natural gas prices are not going to affect this project.
Palmer was at the Capitol to present an update to House and Senate committees. Representatives of the BP ConocoPhillips project were not present due to airline flight conditions. Although he did not say the Denali pipeline is at risk of losing corporate support, BP's Frank told the Industry Alliance over the weekend that the national economy also is having negative effects on the cost of construction of the project, estimated last summer at $26 billion, more recently at more than $30 billion. Palmer says TransCanada is taking a much longer view of those estimates.
Cost of materials have risen, certainly from 2004 through 2008. Oil and gas project inflation was higher than was for consumer price index. This year, they're starting to come down. We'll be doing a new cost estimate over the course of the next 12 months, and we'll see what our overall look is at that time. So a year from now, we'll have a new outlook as to price, and hopefully costs will continue to fall.
Palmer told the committee that the current tolls for users of the TransCanada project have not changed from the $2.76 estimate they made last year. And the company's goal is to keep those tolls at less than $3 per million cubic feet, which would still prove profitable for gas suppliers, even at the current low market prices. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
An outspoken critic of Governor Sarah Palin has filed ethics complaints against two of the governor's top aides, saying they misused their official positions for Palin's personal and political gain. Anchorage resident Andrew McLeod filed the complaints today with Alaska Attorney General Talis Kohlberg. Named are Bill McAllister, Palin's press secretary, and Chris Perry, the governor's top aide in Anchorage. McLeod maintains the two worked on state time to benefit Palin's interests during and after her vice presidential quest. McLeod wants the state personnel board to investigate her allegations. McAllister says McLeod has cost the state $100,000 in public records requests that have uncovered no wrongdoing. He says, quote, "At this point, all we have is another complaint by a person with an obvious vendetta." Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a slain former public safety commissioner is remembered.
When a group of people decide to get together and try and name a mountain after you, it is a great honor.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The candidate list for spring's race for Anchorage mayor just increased to 10. This afternoon, acting mayor Matt Klayman announced he wants to make his temporary position permanent. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Klayman became acting mayor on January 5th, mere moments after Mark Begich resigned. He will hold the position until July 1st, when the new mayor takes over. Anchorage's latest mayoral candidate told those gathered for his announcement at the Hotel Captain Cook that his three-week incumbency had already given him insights not necessarily possessed by the other candidates.
As your acting mayor, I understand the challenges that we face, a $17 million budget shortfall, low oil prices that affect the state treasury, and a national recession.
The municipal charter calls for the chair of the Anchorage Assembly to become acting mayor should the elected mayor resign. Klayman was chair of the Assembly. His first term on the Assembly ends April 2010. Klayman is an attorney who has taken a leave of absence from his law firm to serve in his current duties at City Hall. Klayman did not agree that his temporary status gives him an advantage in the April municipal election. He prefers to describe the value of his current position as one which gives him special insights.
As your acting mayor and as a candidate for mayor, I am committed to a stronger, safer, smarter city. Stronger by solving the manageable financial challenges that we face today. Safer by keeping our commitment to public safety. Smarter by finding innovations for a more efficient city.
And candidate Klayman saw an advantage for the voters.
I don't think of it as an advantage to me. I think of it as an advantage to Anchorage voters because they actually know what they're getting.
The other nine mayoral candidates who have filed with the Alaska Public Offices Commission are Walt Monaghan, former commissioner of the state's Public Safety Department and Anchorage Police Chief, Anchorage Assembly Member Sheila Selcraig, former three-term Anchorage Assembly Member Dan Sullivan, former police spokesman Paul Honeman, and construction company president Dominique S.F. Lee, along with Melanie K. Leiden, Jacob Seth Kern, and Marika Hlatko. The final day for mayoral candidates, and for that matter persons running for the Anchorage School Board to register their candidacy, is February 13th. The Anchorage municipal election takes place April 7th. By municipal charter, a candidate must receive at least 45% of the votes cast to win. If no one achieves the needed percentage, then a runoff election with the top two vote-getters will occur. That election would take place on May 5th. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The Afognak Native Corporation announced the renaming of a mountain on Afognak Island in honor of Glenn G. Godfrey, the first Alaska Native to serve as Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety and Director of the Alaska State Troopers. Godfrey became Director of the Troopers in 1995 before being appointed Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety in 2000 by then-Governor Tony Knowles. He served in the top post for nearly 2 years before his murder in 2002. The new name, Godfrey Mountain, was approved by the U.S. Geological Survey on Geographic Names in December. Megan Peters of the Department of Public Safety in Anchorage said the Native Corporation was responsible for the push to have the mountain renamed for Godfrey. Afognak's board of directors recently informed the department of the honor.
This is something that the Department of Public Safety was recently made aware of. It's not something that we set out to do. It was actually the actions of one of the Native corporations. They set out to make the mountain name change with the U.S. Geological Service, and through its process, the name change was granted and officially took place in December.
Peter said the naming is a fitting tribute to one of the department's historic leaders. She says Glenn Godfrey made significant contributions to the Department of Public Safety during his time there.
Certainly when something like that happens, when a group of people decide to get together and try and name a mountain after you, it is a great honor. And it's something that reflects well upon the Department of Public Safety also. Commissioner Godfrey was definitely a part of our history, and so it's an honor that a member of our organization was bestowed that kind of an honor.
Godfrey Mountain is located 13 miles north of Old Afognak Village on the southwestern coast of Afognak Island, just north of Kodiak Island.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're an artist who expresses yourself creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance, you may be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Awards grant. You can learn more online at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Redoubt Volcano, located about 100 miles southwest of Anchorage, has been kicking up a bit over the last few days, enough so that the Alaska Volcano Observatory has raised its volcano alert level to orange. AVO geologist Chris Way Thomas says that means a geologist will be on staff 24 hours a day monitoring Redoubt. Way Thomas says a big ramp up in seismic activity that started on Friday died off a bit on Sunday.
We're experiencing now what we refer to in the business as volcanic tremor, which is kind of low amplitude seismicity that's relatively continuous. It's often associated with fluid migration, in this case probably gas emission.
An overflight of Redoubt yesterday didn't reveal much. No eruption had taken place. Way Thomas says observers did see steaming through existing holes and they smelled sulfur. Another flight today should help geologists understand what, if any, changes may be taking place. Way Thomas says the big Redoubt eruptions that happened in 1989 and 1990 produced a lot of ash and mud flow into the Drift River. Updates can be found at avo.alaska.edu. The state's Board of Fish last week heard testimony over proposals to open and close a number of areas in Southeast to commercial fishing for Dungeness crab. Some proposals seek to end commercial harvests around some Southeast towns, but there are also attempts to reopen some closed commercial spots. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
One commercial Dungeness closure is proposed for the north end of the Wrangell Narrows near Petersburg. Mitkoff Island resident Denny Heimdall said he wanted to have some part of the waterway closed to the commercial fleet.
I am for the intent of that proposal, which was to have an area near Petersburg here where personal use people, sport fishers, could go and get a Dungeness crab without risking their gear during commercial fishing seasons or being after the commercial fishing season when there is no crab there.
There are currently 16 closed areas in Southeast, many of them nearby communities, to allow better crab catches for Southeast dinner tables. Commercial fishing groups and individuals testified in opposition to any new commercial closures. Petersburg crabber Mark Jensen said the Wrangell Narrows is not facing a problem with its crab numbers, and he said a closure would impact the local fleet.
A lot of those boats are skiffs that need to fish in protected waters. And if you close this area, commercial fishing, you're going to displace them. Either that or they're going to have to make a bigger investment and buy a larger boat so they can go out and compete with grounds that are already getting over, I wouldn't say overfished, crowded. And one of those reasons is from predation by sea otters.
The board considered a similar proposal for the Wrangell Narrows in 2003 and did not adopt it. Board members have several other commercial closure proposals to consider this year. Those include proposed closures at Naugatuck Bay on western Prince of Wales Island and around Kaufman Cove on the eastern shore of Prince of Wales. There's also an attempt to reopen some areas the board has already closed. Southeast Alaska Fishermen's Alliance, a commercial fishing group, is seeking to reopen a fall crab fishery near the Prince of Wales community of Whale Pass. The group's proposal says summer residents are not around to crab during the fall season. However, Whale Pass resident Johnny Thompson testified against that reopening.
I've been in Whale Pass for probably, since 94. I was there before they closed the bay up, and we didn't have any crab. When they closed the bay, you can catch crab. So it's a matter, there's 57 people living in Whale Pass right now, and every one of them was at the board meeting and asked me to come here. And every one of them asked that the bay stay closed because they remember when we could catch crabs and they also remember when we couldn't.
And Jackie Tyson, a resident of Mitkoff Island, also spoke against that whale pass reopening.
Balancing the resource between commercial fishers and subsistence and recreational users is tough, but I feel we need to preserve small closed areas that are near our towns. They provide easily accessible historical and unique fishing experiences. They could serve as protected baseline areas where populations are relatively undisturbed populations of crab.
Commercial fishing interests are also seeking to reopen other closed areas. Pete Roddy, a Sitka commercial crabber and salmon troller, supported a reopening of Shake Bay south of Angoon. The board closed that area to commercial dungy crabbing in 2006.
The premise for the closure was that people of Angoon needed a place to subsistence fish, and that there was nowhere closer, such as Hood Bay, since there were no crab in Hood Bay. The premise is false. There are crab in Hood Bay. And over the 20-some years I've been fishing in Shake, I've really never seen any subsistence use. I've only seen a charter boat and lodge people.
Roddy also said he supported a separate proposal seeking to close areas to sport fishing for Dungeness that are already closed for commercial crabbing. Southeast Alaska Fishermen's Alliance has also submitted a proposal to reduce the bag and possession limits for sport caught Dungeness and Tanner crab. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
A surefire way to reduce global warming is to burn less fossil fuel. Coal, oil, and natural gas have generated some of the carbon emissions that have started heating the planet. But these days, you can also pay someone else to deal with carbon for you. And that could mean a new source of income in Southeast Alaska. As John Ryan reports, giant trees and deep, wet soil make Southeast Alaska one of the nation's largest storehouses of carbon.
Anybody who's watched Star Trek knows humans are a carbon-based life form. So are trees and fish and the ancient fossilized plants that now fuel human civilization. When any carbon-based thing burns or decomposes, it releases carbon dioxide. When plants grow, they take that CO2 out of the sky. In a nutshell, that's the carbon cycle. And that's what brings Rick Edwards snowshoeing into the forest near Fish Creek on Douglas Island.
It's a beautiful, gorgeous place here. And some lovely big trees down here in the riparian. So.
He's a stream researcher with the U.S. Forest Service. He and his colleagues are trying to figure out how much carbon goes where as it cycles between land, air, and water.
In general, Southeast Alaska is very carbon rich.
Edwards says about 7% of all carbon stored in American forests is in the Tongass.
Coastal temperate rainforests are cool year-round, and they're waterlogged. And these two factors inhibit decomposition, so allow carbon to build up on the landscape.
Edwards studies carbon because he's a scientist. He just likes understanding how ecosystems work. But as world leaders race against the climate clock to reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, interest is rapidly growing in the carbon cycle.
We're very interested now in how much carbon is sequestered within the soils and the plants, because the carbon that's stored as organic matter on the surface of the earth is not in the atmosphere contributing to global warming.
Many states and nations have started putting legal limits on CO2 emissions. They're allowing companies to exceed those limits if they pay someone else to offset their carbon emissions. Here in Juneau, groups ranging from the Nature Conservancy to the Sea Alaska Native Corporation are exploring how to tap into this emerging carbon market. Nathan Sobolev is a natural resources planner with Sea Alaska.
The potential for carbon credits within Southeast Alaska is potentially one of the largest banks of carbon storage within North America, possibly within the world.
Sea Alaska has already liquidated much of its carbon inventory by logging its older forests. But Sobolev says it's possible to suck more carbon out of the air by actively managing younger forests.
The carbon, provided that it goes into a long-term product like a 2x4 or a guitar top, if that wood goes into those types of products as opposed to turning it into cellulose for paper or other things like that, that carbon is stored.
Most of the carbon in a Southeast Alaskan forest is in the soil, not in tree trunks. Scientists are still studying whether you can increase carbon storage by taking logs out of a forest. Some environmental groups think the new trade in carbon credits is so much greenwashing. Backers of carbon markets say strict protocols and third-party verification will ensure that carbon really will stay on the ground and not return to the sky. Back in the coastal forest of Douglas Island, scientists are discovering there's another way a lot of carbon might escape the rainforest. This branch of Fish Creek is frozen solid enough to walk on, but water still gurgles beneath the ice. Forest Service researcher Rick Edwards explains why the ice is brown.
And that brown color is from dissolved organic carbon, the organic form of carbon, and by dissolved, it's just tiny rather than leaves and sticks. Kind of gives you a glimpse frozen in time at how much carbon is coming out in the water.
Edwards says nearly a million tons of carbon washes off the Tongass every year. That's more than three times as much as loggers have chopped down in any single year on the Tongass. Researchers think about half the carbon that washes out to sea is biodegradable, meaning bacteria and other organisms can turn it back into carbon dioxide. Soil scientist Dave DeMore with the Forest Service says it's part of the carbon cycle that's been overlooked.
We also need to understand this dissolved flux because it's so huge. We've underestimated it, and we may be missing a large component that we're actually losing and out of that system that we're not accounting for.
The researchers say it will be several years before they can tell carbon traders just how reliable the Tongass is as a carbon bank. Nathan Sobolev with Sea Alaska says there's another hitch when it comes to selling carbon credits from Alaska. Because the Alaskan government has not set any limits on its carbon emissions or joined in any carbon trading schemes, carbon credits aren't worth much here compared to other parts of the world. To date, the Palin administration has declined to join the Western Climate Initiative. That's a coalition of seven governors and four Canadian premiers. They've committed to reducing the region's carbon dioxide emissions. The group is putting the finishing touches on a cap and trade system for carbon. It will cover 20% of the U.S. economy and about three-fourths of the Canadian economy. Alaska is sitting on the sidelines as an observer of the two-year-old effort. The Palin administration has emphasized protecting Alaska's economy from the impacts of a changing climate. Protecting the climate from the impacts of the Alaskan economy has been a lower priority. In her vice presidential debate against Senator Joe Biden last fall, Governor Palin said she supports putting a cap on carbon emissions. She also said she didn't want to argue about whether human activities or natural cycles are causing climate change. That led the science website realclimate.org to dub Palin the most clueless U.S. politician of 2008. In a letter addressed to Alaskans last summer, before she became a national political figure, Governor Palin said, "All life on Earth shares one atmosphere, and each nation, each state, bears a responsibility to all to protect it." I'm John Ryan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Eric Wander in Kodiak, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Joe Viknicki in Petersburg, and John Ryan in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Proffitt is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.